So, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Mississippi Anthropocene Project, let me just tell you a little bit about what it's about. And we are a group of scholars, artists, researchers, civic leaders who came together about a year ago to think about the future of the river. And we're one of many groups from here in Minneapolis through to New Orleans that have formed into what we've been calling field stations. So this piece is called Field Station 1. There are several other field stations downstream. They are also holding public events over the next several weeks. And we do this in partnership with our colleagues at the Hack Bay and with the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. And some of our friends from Germany are here with us tonight. I also wanted to mark, after this session is done, there are interactive exhibits, installations behind you. It's all noted in this program here. So we have behind us a listening to the Mississippi Station, a Mississippi Mud Stencil Workshop, and a couple of other events here. I'm not sure exactly where they're located on the... That's it. Okay, John Tillman. And then the film screening at sunset. So this panel tonight brings together a group of scholars and practitioners who are deeply knowledgeable and deeply invested in the future of the river. And as part of our field station, I've been working with my colleagues, Bruce, who's sipping the water, Bruce Braun and Morgan Adamson for the last year to explore themes of deindustrialization, of infrastructure development, of the speculative futures and pasts of the Mississippi River in the context of the Twin Cities. And so we've been puzzling through a whole range of questions. We've been wondering how the processes of deindustrialization are opening up new ways to think about the river, and how it still continues to be shaped by colonial and capitalist processes. But also, what are investments, our social, our financial, our personal investments, what are they in the river's future? And how does the past, present, and the future of the infrastructure shape not just the natural environment, but also the social lives that we live here in the Twin Cities? So we invited, the three of us invited our speakers, and I'll note there's one additional person, Shania Mattson, that's not part of our panel today, but we invited these thought leaders to write a reflective essay for us about a specific site along the Mississippi that engaged with some of those questions that I just described. And the reflections, the essays that they wrote are personal, they're poetic, they are academically engaged, they are really struggling with not just specific sites, but how we assemble those sites in this stretch of the river. And so these pieces are part of a special collection that will be hosted on the Mississippi Anthropocene website and hopefully in a future issue of the journal Open Rivers. And our guests here are speaking from those essays. And if you're curious, I encourage you then to follow the links in the booklet and you can look up the entire essays. Before, yes?
Soon.
Now, before I turn it over to the speakers, I want to take this opportunity as the first session of this two-day period to acknowledge where we are today on the banks of the Mississippi River. So our panel, and really the entire field station project from Field Station 1 and on, is created by a collective of people, each of us differently positioned toward the places in which and about which that we write. We share the context of working and living on traditional, ancestral, and contemporary homelands of the Dakota, the Ho-Chunk, the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe, so many Native nations. We acknowledge the overlapping histories of the region, including the continued conditions of stolen indigenous land and power, and the ongoing violences of racial slavery. We also recognize that the institutions with which we are linked have been complicit in the erasures of history and continue to benefit and perpetuate processes of colonialization, broken treaties, dispossession, and displacement. We work collectively to educate ourselves, our campuses, our students, our communities about this complex history and its contemporary manifestations. And in recognition of these considerations, we have endeavored to work collaboratively and critically with a very diverse group of participants from the onset of this project. So when this river journey began at the end of August, there were a number of activities that kicked off the Mississippi Anthropocene Project that engaged with the late Itasca region and with the Line 3 pipeline and with several indigenous communities during the launch of the project. And this was our way of not just acknowledging these important issues, but also taking them into the practice of this work. So the collection of essays that we've pulled together also grapple with these complex and layered stories. So with that, I'm going to turn to our panelists. In the interest of time, I'm not going to give you long introductions, although I'm sure I could say so much about each of these wonderful people. I will ask them to introduce themselves before they make their remarks. So we have six speakers, and we decided to flow against the river and start downstream and make our way upstream to Minneapolis. So I'm going to start with Pat Nunnally.
Thank you. Hello, my relatives. I am Pat Nunnally. I work for the University of Minnesota at a series of programs that try to help the university live up to its location. The university is on the banks of one of the great rivers of the world, in a national park, and in the homeland of Dakota people. We have worked in my program for a very long time with Dakota people, and they've taught me a phrase, I'm not Dakota, and I know there are Dakota people here. I apologize for mispronouncing what I'm about to say and what I'll say later in my remarks, but a phrase that I've been taught is Mokoche Kinde Dakota Tamakoche, which roughly translates as, in this place, the Dakota and the land belong to each other. It's a way of expressing the ongoing reciprocity of land and people that are here. The place I want to talk about is one that is readily overlooked. It's downstream from here. It is known by many names. It has been known from the time of Dakota people, among other things, as containing Wakan Tipi. It also is Imnizaska, which generally means white cliffs, and was one of the Dakota names for the place that is now St. Paul. It was also a place where the Kapoza group would occasionally be. The Kapoza band was one that was known for moving around a great deal. With the advent of settlers and industrialists, the area's land and water were changed remarkably, so that much of the area that is now land was formerly water, and it was converted for the purposes of creating rail yards. And I'm sure it has names that were part of the various rail companies that were inhabiting that place as a rail company. After the demise of the heavy use of the railroads, the place was largely forgotten and became known as kind of a wasteland until local people, primarily folks at the Friends of Sweet Hollow and the Laurel Field and Creek Project, began to work starting 25 years ago at making this something that was part of a community asset rather than a community hazard. And this is a place where people had been dumping material and was down below, and it was sort of under the place, out of sight. And so people begin to work, and I think it's really important to notice that over the last 25 years, the work that's been done started with community efforts. It included nonprofit work like the Trust for Public Land, and it included government work at all levels. The City of St. Paul is involved, the Minnesota DNR is involved, the federal government has been involved, so that now the place has been known since the early aughts, I guess, as the Bruce Vento Nature Sanctuary. Bruce Vento was a congressman from this St. Paul area who was responsible for creating the national park here in the first place. So what do we know of this? I mean, it's hard to say what has happened there. Is it reclaimed? Is it restored? Is it renewed? I don't know, and I would invite all of us to think about those words and others that we use when we think about what we're doing with the future of these places. It's easy to think of the Vento Sanctuary in Neyeska as a place that is part of infrastructure, it's part of histories, that is part of connections of upstream and downstream, it's part of many things that the Anthropocene gives us a framework to understand. But I would ask you to remember also that this place, like all the places we'll talk about tonight, must be understood in their own right, as their own place that is important as a place. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. My name is Morgan Adamson. I teach at McAllister College in the Media and Cultural Studies Department with John Kim, who should be recognized as the conductor of this Anthropocene train, boat, barge, whatever it is that we are currently embarking on. So John has done tons of work to make this event happen, and we really appreciate everything he's done. So I'm just going to keep my comments really briefly. Moving a bit upriver, I wanted to talk a bit about the research I've been doing over the summer on two sites, really, but primarily on this site in downtown St. Paul, right along the riverfront, that has been reimagined by the city as a site of development. And so the picture that you're looking at now is four buildings and a large development that have been proposed by a company called AECOM, which is out of LA but has worked in Dubai, helped build the World Trade Center, did the Rio de Janeiro Olympics, so a huge Fortune 500 real estate investment and infrastructure company who has come to the Twin Cities and proposed a $800 million development right along the shores of the city of St. Paul that is composed of a luxury office building, a luxury condo, a luxury hotel. You're seeing a theme develop here, and a lot of luxury retail, and some places for the public to walk around too. So there's not one unit of affordable housing in this entire development, and the AECOM has proposed to give the city of St. Paul $5 million to build affordable housing elsewhere, because of course people who need affordable housing shouldn't be able to live by the river, and they're also, in addition to all of this, they're asking, so the city is giving them this site to build on. It's already invested $15 million in taking away all of the old industrial infrastructure and buildings that were there. And, sorry, what?
Jail.
And there was a jail. There was a lot of, apparently I have a friend who stayed at the jail overnight and said there was a great view. But anyway, so the city's already invested $15 million in making this site ready, in getting the site ready for developers, and it has given the site to the developers, essentially, and the developers are now asking for $80 million from the city to help with the infrastructure, which the city is going to the state to get a bonding bill passed. So anyway, this is going to cost the public upwards of $95 million, with the hopes that it will spark economic revitalization. So in my research, what I've been... Oh, 2 minutes. Oh, wow, I'm talking too much. So in my research, what I've been really looking at is the way that deindustrialization in the Twin Cities has been taken on as along the riverfront especially, has been taken on as a kind of opportunity for developers. And the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis have often been all too eager to kind of give over these sites to developers, essentially for free, which are sites owned by the public. And so the problem, and there's a lot of problems with this, but the main issue is the way that the river has become a kind of amenity for real estate capital, something that raises the value of the adjacent land, rather than
all of the complex things that it is and that we're going to be talking about over the next 2 days. So really what I've been kind of researching is this shift towards real estate speculation in the wake of deindustrialization in the Twin Cities. And I think the Upper Harbor Terminal is another really great example. And so, I'll just leave it there. Thanks.
I don't really know how to follow that and speak with so much vomit in my mouth. Throwing up the whole time we're talking. Bonjour, Nindinawe Maganidok, Kagiaseik, Nindago, Andrea Carlson, Nindago, Jaganoshimo, Mikanak Nindodim, Chicago, Nindun Chaba, Gicheo Negaming, Jinakade, Ishkonagan, Miigwech Pisandawiyeg. So my name is Andrea Carlson and I'm an artist. And I was asked to be part of this project. I was asked to contribute to the online curriculum. And when Bruce first contacted me about the possibility of writing on a site around Bedote, around the Twin Cities area, around this place, I thought a lot about terms and terminology and the terms that we use. I don't consider the Twin Cities area. I don't consider Ouamani, which is turbulent waters, which is where we all are, this Dakota sacred place. I don't consider Bedote. I don't consider it a site. I don't consider it a field station. This is Field Station 1. I see it as a home. And I think that a lot of the language that we use around places, especially how science tries to, you know, extract and find objectivity and separate people from the places that we live. It's really hard for me to consider a place that I've considered a home as a site, as something separate from myself. So when I wrote, I kind of I think I might have lied to you guys at first and said, I think I'll write on this place in St. Paul, and then that what I ended up turning in had much more to do with the people that I've grown to love and the people that have been working so hard to restore water and to restore water to what it once was. I don't know if anyone is aware of the water activist named Autumn Peltier, but she's from Manitoulin Island. She when she was 15 years old, she spoke to the UN a couple of years ago. And she gave an Ojibwe teaching that I know very well, and since she gave it, I feel like I can give it because it's, you know, out in the world, it's out public. And she talked about how women in Ojibwe culture are considered water carriers. How each of us are carried in our mother's womb for 9 months in a bowl of water, and how, if you think of your mother who carried you, she was carried in water for 9 months, and her mom was carried for in water for 9 months, and how that is an ancient river going all the way back to the beginning of people. So when we look at this river, it's not that we're dominating this river. It's that we are the river. We are part of the river. We are not separate from the river. We are, I'm sure there's a scientist in here who can correct me, but we're over 75% water, and that connects all of us. So when the Dakota say, all my relations, when they talk about how we are all related, they're talking about this water that is in all of us. We are all related. Water is life, because it connects every single one of us. So when I think of the Anthropocene, and I think of the Mississippi River as being a river of the Anthropocene, I think of us as being part of that river, not apart from it. It's really hard for me to consider dominating something and a thing that's in a temporality when, you know, we don't have hindsight yet. We haven't made it out of this era to be able to name it or to put characteristics on it. So that's kind of the approach I took, which was very contrarian, perhaps. It wasn't my my intention. I didn't set out to do that. I've just been thinking about these things a lot. So I don't know. I have some slides too, but maybe we'll get to them later.
Is there one you'd like us to just put up for a
minute? No, I'll just pass my Migos.
Good evening. I'm Bruce Braun. I teach at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Geography. And thanks for so many of you coming out tonight. We had no idea whether we were going to be talking to five people or we're going to be talking to like 50. And I'm just thrilled that so many people wanted to be out here and listening to this. I also just wanted to give a shout out to Morgan Adamson and Michael Cheney, who put on a wonderful event this afternoon at the Upper Harbor. So thanks, Michael and Morgan, for all the organization on that. So we're at this moment where the many different kinds of futures are being imagined for the river. And they're being imagined in the context of deindustrialization. A river that has been understood as infrastructure now being thought of as having other potential history and other futures. And we all took sites to sort of think this through. Andrea took the what I think was the appropriate kind of like contrarian. I like it when people actually write back against the way you framed it in the beginning. It actually makes it way more interesting. The approach that I took, and I'll confess that my essay, because I'm one of the organizers, isn't as finished as the rest, so these are sort of preliminary thoughts. But the question I decided to sort of ponder and think about is, at this moment, when we're thinking about alternative futures for the river, what might it mean to go back to an earlier moment and think about what was at stake in thinking futures at that point? So I decided to use the Meeker Dam as a provocation for that. The Meeker Dam, how many of you know where the Meeker Dam is? Okay, John's written about it, so you know, he knows a lot about it. He knows way more than me, than I do, about this dam. It's located just south of the Short Line Bridge, which is this that tall railway bridge between the Franklin and Lake. And it is a dam which was built in 1907, and it was basically destroyed in 1907, completed then, and destroyed in 1912. It was destroyed because Lock Dam number one, which was slightly downstream, was a larger dam and made this dam basically irrelevant. So it was basically, you know, dismantled. The ruins of this dam are still there. And what's interesting about it is that it's mostly covered most of the year with water. And at certain points when the water level drops, almost like a ghostly apparition, this dam rises out of the water. And one of the things I wanted to do this summer was do video at different points of the dam emerging and disappearing and emerging and disappearing. But it rained so much this summer, and the Army Corps of Engineers was uncooperative, so it stayed submerged for the whole year, and that project just went down the tubes. But what I want to think about is to think from the perspective of that, of a particular historical juncture in the present. Because the dam was completed in 1907, but it was first proposed in 1852. And when I realized that, it made me actually think about a whole lot of questions. And one of the things that is worth thinking about is that in 1852, we'll just skip over to some other notes here. In 1852, the Treaty of Traverse de Sioux, is that what I think it's called, had just been signed. It was just months after that was signed. The Dakota Uprising was still a decade in the future. The concentration camps at Fort Snelling were simply a kind of a latent potential within settler colonialism. So what does it mean that at that historical juncture, this river is already being imagined, not as an indigenous space? In fact, there's no recognition of indigenous space, of Dakota space. It's simply understood as a river in which it becomes an infrastructural river, becomes imagined as an infrastructural river. And it's turned into a problem to be solved, a mechanical, a geological, a fluid, a hydrological puzzle, a puzzle that has to do with how do you hold water back? How do you let it flow at the right time through the right spaces? How do you move barges up a river? Maybe we can move to the next image here. A river that's too shallow, its drop is too steep. How to regulate flows so that commodities can be more, can be moved to market, investments realized, speculations in land made profitable, and so on. So it becomes this problem to be solved. The river becomes that. And what's most striking when you go back into the historical documents around the Meeker Dam is that the assumption of a settler futurity is just taken for granted. And that's the really shocking thing. It's 1852. This dam is just the projection of a settler future is simply... Okay, I'll just take one more minute to sort of wrap up. Sorry, Father, wasn't watching you. And there's no other consideration of other futures, other possible ontologies, other temporalities, territorializations. So the question I come to in this paper is, what does it mean to go back to that historical moment today when we're asking questions again about the future? What kind of futurities are being proposed? What is being erased? What is being projected as a matter of course? And part of the essay, and I'll just, this is the last thing I'll just say, is that one of the things I try to think through is what it means to think of ourselves as inheritors of the Meeker Dam. And what does that mean in terms of a set of responsibilities? To think that we inherit that dam, we inherit that way of understanding the river and the erasures that were part of that. Thanks.
So my name is John Ampinson. I'm the superintendent of the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area. How many people know they're in a national park right now? Yes, we're making improvements. So I began my essay before I was even asked to write it. I began it because out of extreme frustration with the Upper Harbor Terminal project, that I could attend meeting after meeting, and the developers never once mentioned that this site they were developing was on one of the greatest rivers in the world. Mississippi River not even mentioned. Not once did they mention that land was within a unit of America's national park system. And I thought, for all the years we've been working to get people to appreciate this as a world-renowned river, and that we should treat it like that, instead of treating it like we did in the 19th and 20th centuries, we should treat it like what represents the 21st century. But I started writing an essay just, like I say, out of pure frustration. And so when I was asked to contribute something, I was like, wow, I already got this right. I started, I got to cut it in half, but I can, because that's how long my frustration was, or started to reflect it. But so I started thinking about what this place was. And the city's River First plan talks about economic engines, that we need economic engines above the falls, above this point, which has long been called the Forgotten River. So what would an economic engine up there look like? I mean, this is 48 acres, 1 mile of a riverfront, across from North Minneapolis, one of the most diverse communities and the one that needs among the most help of any of the cities. So what kind of economic engine does that place get or need? And so I realized that the first economic engine was the lumber industry. It lasted for about 50 years. There are all kinds of lumber mills up there. It made a lot of people really rich. It helped build the city. By 1916, the last lumber mill quit producing. In 1921, not a single mill was even left. All had been erased up there. So lumber milling was based on a fiction. It was based on the fiction that lumber, timber in the north was endless. So what's the next project coming in the 1970s? That Minneapolis can be the bookend to New Orleans, commercially. This will be the powerhouse, the commercial bookend to Minneapolis. And so we need navigation to get above the falls so that Minneapolis can prosper as a head of navigation. That didn't even last nearly as long. It's already been closed. This lock has been closed. So that was based on the fiction of being the head of navigation. So what is the next economic engine for the river above the falls going to be? What will it be based on? Will it be sustainable? Will it be 21st century? Will it serve everyone? And I look at something like, you know, one of the best economic engines the Twin Cities has been? There's no factories associated with it. It's called the Grand Rounds. It's called the Parkway System. It's been an economic engine for over 100 years. And it's how many people has it helped? How many people has it served? How diverse an audience does it serve? So I just want to leave you with that thought, and I'm going to turn it over to Michael.
Thank you. every day. Good day. North Minneapolis is going green. Give us a call and learn what we mean. Where once lay urban blight, now sits luscious garden sites, gardens without borders, classrooms without walls, architects of our own destinies, access to food, justice for all. Hello, my name is Michael Chang. I'm an activist, organizer. In the 80s, I was the founder of the Juneteenth celebration, spent 18 years growing it to one of the largest Juneteenth celebrations in the nation. In the 90s, I was the founder of the Wendell Phelps Credit Union, the first out of the NRP process, and created the Wendell Phelps Credit Union. And in 2010, when North High came under attack, myself and others came forward out of a group called AfroEco, because we could not sit back in good conscience and watch school administrators kill the school, because we felt that the killing of the school is the killing of the heart of any community. And so we created what's called Project Sweetie Pie, the story of a community that came together, worked together for the common good of the youth and families of its community, for it takes a village to raise a child. And so I'm an artist. I spent 25 years working for Fox TV as a cameraman, so much of my work is framed around art. And so eventually, over those 10 years, we created the first urban egg legislation in the nation. 4 years ago, the governor of Minnesota allocated $500,000 to train youth across the state of Minnesota. And this last session, they allocated $300,000 for the next 4 years. And we approached them with the idea that if we're going to build a local economy, a local food system, then we have to build infrastructure, we have to have resources. If we're going to sustain this idea of being the breadbasket for America, then we have to invest in our future. And that future led me to the Upper Harbor when I was asked to come and join them and build a food hub. And I told them I didn't want to do a food hub. They said, well, why, Michael? You work with food. I said, number one, people have tried it, they've failed, and they've left a sour taste in the minds of legislators and in philanthropy. I said, I want to start an eco-village, an environmental impact center that would be a lighthouse and a lightning rod on the Mississippi River, so that we could indeed set the narrative for the nation around global warming and climate change. Mississippi, great river. Fur traders and slave raiders and industrial coal agers, they claimed her as their savior, yet they MISSISSIPPI treated her foul. Pollutants what they gave her in exchange for all her favors. And now we piddle, pedal, paddle fast past our dirty, ugly past in a desperate attempt to try to save ourselves from exploding greenhouse gas. And so I moved forward to really try to frame this Upper Harbor in this idea, because I did not want to, and this started 2 years ago, so like John, I've already written my piece, and I've been traveling around the country for the last years, kind of like raising the bar, raising the expectation, and raising the awareness, kind of the town crier, you know, the guy who's this town crier trying to get folks to realize that this Mississippi River is our pathway to the future, and it's a chance for us to really take the work of Cleveland and Falwell, who at the turn of the century had enough humanity and largesse of spirit that they believed that all people, regardless of race, creed, color, and economic station, that nature was the majesty of all people. And they realized that if they did not set across land for the future, that the people yet unborn would pay a high price. They would be excluded from the river. And so that really became the kind of the core for the work as I traveled to Chicago, to Policy Link, and to U.S. Alliance, trying to get them to realize that they needed to come on board and let's move forward to set this, follow in the footsteps of Cleveland Falwell. Sold down river, sitting eerily quiet on the corner of First Avenue and Minneapolis Port Road, sits one of Minneapolis's, and in particular North Minneapolis's, greatest secrets. Like a phantom, this 48 acres of land sits beneath the radar, off the grid, in another world. To the unwitting, uninformed average Joe, it is the former home of Northern Metals, but to those who make it their business to keep in the know up on what's going on behind the scenes, this juicy plum of real estate is known as the Upper Harbor Terminal. And to an even narrower, average class of rarefied air power elite, the Upper Harbor Terminal Development. The question remains, will the Upper Harbor Terminal Development be a pathway to prosperity for residents of a disenfranchised and marginalized community, or will it be business as usual? Another tragic footnote in history where greedy self-serving speculators facilitated by the public servants we elected to lead rush in to rob us of our natural heritage as the rightful heir to this place and time. If that becomes the case, it will prove once again, unfortunately, to be just another dead-end street for the sons and daughters of North Minneapolis. Asante San.
Thanks for all our speakers. This is the most disciplined panel I've ever had the pleasure of moderating. Not only did people not take up their full 5 minutes, we've got 15 minutes to spare to have a conversation. So I want to welcome your questions. If you're nearby, I'll pass you the mic. If you're in the back, you might need to holler.
So where are we at this moment with Upper Harbor? What's the status or whatever? And then, that's it.
This has been a process that's been going on for quite some time. They have, like I said, the developers of it are United Properties, Dana Frank's First Avenue. They primarily, what they want to do is they want to build a 10,000-seat amphitheater on the river. And we've been pushing back against that because we think that there's greater value in what John alluded to in kind of the natural amenities and really changing the paradigm. How can we build community from the grassroots up rather than from the top down? And so they are moving forward. They've been doing these kind of dog and pony shows. We were able to stall them off. They're going to be going to the state legislature asking for $15 million of each and every one of our money. And unfortunately, when you talk to North Minneapolis residents, number one, they don't know about it. Number two, they weren't asked about it. And number three, they'll never enter into those walls. It's not much different than a kind of a mini-me of the Viking Stadium or the Twin Stadium. You know, we will pay for a pleasure palace for the rich, and unfortunately, we will never step inside of that. And so we're hoping to create a different model that can actually create ownership. My mantra is instead of 40 acres of mule, let's do 48 acres and a school framed around art and culture, historical preservation, food and urban farming, and all things ecological. And then the Venn diagram is research and development, applied education, workforce development, experiential learning, internships, apprenticeships, and then frame that on a base foundation with public-private partnerships. And we really see it as this is a chance for us to really restore, reform, and really look at even a model in terms of what, number one, what the Green New Deal might look like, but even more importantly, what reparations might look like. How do we restore the displaced Dakota people? How do we restore, and so really, it's really like going back in time, you know, from the East Coast, even the Trail of Tears, how can we make right the wrongs of those who came before us and really put together a healthy model where we're not continually creating a divisive society where we're pitted against each other, all races, creeds. I don't think any of us enjoy animus of race, and so it's really time for us to really look at this as a really restoration project, a reparation project, a reform project, where we can bring everybody to the table to become that same $15 million that Dana Franks wants. I don't really think that any of ours should be, our great-great-grandchildren should be supporting her great-great-grandchildren. But could we take that $15 million and talk about ownership? Because anything short of ownership is still sharecropping.
questions? You look like a bunch of students from one of these professor schools. I was trying to get a talk. No offense.
Well, they talk more than this. We can ask questions.
Go ahead. You got a question? Here, speak in the microphone.
Why is there a huge border thing that separates the water?
That's for you, John.
So the question was, why is there a huge lock here?
A big wall
right here. So a boat used to come in here, and then they'd fill that whole thing up like a bathtub, and then the boat would float up, and they'd open up the doors at that end, and the boat would go out. But they closed it in 2015, so it doesn't work. Or 2016, so it doesn't. 15, so it doesn't work anymore. So this dam is closed permanently to navigation.
Trip over this quarry.
What are the plans for this area?
So what are the plans for this area? I think that one's on me.
John, another question down there.
Well, Michelle, can we just answer this question? I'll come to you. So in 2015, this lot closed. It's no longer used for navigation. The Corps of Engineers' position is that, why do they want to keep it? They want to spend money where there's navigation. So they have started a disposition study to dispose of this lock and dam, to get rid of it. They said, imagine a for sale sign on it. Because the Congress closed this lock, any barge that went through Lower Sanctuary Falls just below us in Lock and Dam 1 had to go through here. So in essence, it closed the other two. So the Corps is doing a disposition study for all three. I'll make this really quick. There's a change in the law this last year, so now they've restarted the disposition study. They're going to look at no action. They're going to look at disposal, giving it to somebody if anybody wants it. And last, they're going to look at disposing of part of it, with part of it going repurposed for a world-class visitor center, potentially transforming this into a world-class visitor center where people can just get right out there anytime they want. American Rivers came in and got a new law passed that says the Corps has to look at dam removal downstream, that you would remove the next two dams downstream and restore the rapids. The river falls 110 feet from just above us to the mouth of the Minnesota River, 8.5 miles downstream. The rapids that once flowed through that was so incredible that in 1858, steamboats came and went 1,000 times from St. Paul, 50 times from Minneapolis. So if you restored the gorge, took out those dams, you'd have the rapids back, but you'd lose some hydroelectric power. So from an Anthropocene perspective, what do you want?
Michelle, if you had a question.
Thank you. One of the very many frustrations we've had with the Upper Harbor Terminal Project has been the lack of outreach to Native populations to get feedback. And I'm curious if that was the same thing that happened with St. Paul development.
I don't know that much about what kind of outreach they've done, if any, but I sincerely doubt it. The city has just been going around and looking for big developers to come in and sweetening the deal as much as they can. From the project that was proposed, it doesn't seem like there's much collaboration with anyone. I mean, it looks like something that would have been built in anywhere, you know, Miami, Dubai, wherever, you know, it's just something that's being plopped down.
I've got a slightly different take, and everybody out there who knows me, and I know there's about three or four of you who do, will not be surprised that I have a different take. I agree that it looks like it could be anywhere, and I agree that the notion that it's luxury-driven is problematic, and that it is not respecting of this place is problematic. But the Great River Passage and the Great River Passage Conservancy, which are part of the overall work get this project done, has done a very great deal of engagement with Dakota people and Ojibwe people. There are indigenous people on their board, so there's an awareness there of multiple perspectives rather than just hanging out the for sale sign. They actually tried to hang out the for sale sign for a long time and didn't find any takers. So trying a new approach and packaging that set apart projects in with things on the East Side District and things on further upstream is part of a more generative sense of how they might be trying to think about the riverfront in St. Paul.
More nuance.
I think it was just answered. But there's some interesting phrases coming out right now in Indigenous activism. Everyone's probably familiar with ideas around decolonization. A lot of Indigenous people right now see the term decolonization as still centering the settler. And so a new term that is starting to be used in museums and in places of authority is this term indigenization, to indigenize a place, to really center Indigenous people in a lot of programming that's around us. You'll sometimes hear the term not about us, without us. There's a lot of non-Native Native experts, people who aren't Native who are experts at Native things, and we're on to that. So I think when I think of some of the terminology around, like, say, deindustrialization and how these terms still kind of center industrialization, like, how can we repurpose this for, you know, another, just another industrialization? How can we center ourselves? So there's this term, repatriation, which a lot of times when things have been stolen from our graves and put in museums, when things have been taken from us, repatriation means to bring back to the nation of origin. So there's this term coming up right now that's like rematriation, rematriate the land. And I think that that's kind of an interesting term when we think of, like, this sacred place. Hespier Island used to exist, you know, just downstream of Stone Arch Bridge, and it doesn't exist anymore because of this lock and dam. We're looking at a coffin. This was only functional for 50 odd years. So when I think of that, when I think of the destruction of a Dakota sacred place to make this thing that only ran for 50 some years, and how we're willing to take old things and sacrifice them for new things that only last for a little bit of time, I think of future development and how you can't have any of these conversations without Dakota women. And that's why rematriate the land, I think, is a really interesting term that's being kind of thrown about in the Indigenous resistance community. So that's, I mean, as far as terminology, I think that I've also been thinking about the Anthropocene a lot lately. And so I was thinking about, is there a way that we can, you know, if we're going to give personhood, if we're going to think of the river as a person, you know, is there a way of, like, anti-Anthropocenification? Are we at that tipping point? If we aren't, is there a way we can identify it and kind of highlight it for removal? So I've been thinking about that a lot lately, as far as the terms we use.
The question was, is strategy, when is the date in terms of asking for? They actually, this last session went, interesting enough, Dana Franks would quote a figure that she's already invested $2 million toward her plan and her development of these ideas. And so strangely enough, oddly enough, this last request over at the state capitol, this last session, was for $2 million to, and so they're talking about $15 million that they want to go toward public investment. And so, yeah, we have been mobilizing. There's a group of us, there's three or four of us that are here tonight that would be more than happy to take your name, called the Eco Harbor. Like I said, we've been working on this for about the last 2 years as kind of the resistance to this dumbfounded idea. And recently we've started working on, I was out in South Dakota where the Indigenous Decade of Water Thorne, LaPointe, and a number of people did, and they brought in some folks from New Zealand, which was one of the first places that did personhood for one of their rivers there. So we went out and met with those folks, and so we're moving to work toward personhood of the river. And so they may own the land space, in at least in theory, but they don't own the airspace, the intellectual properties. And so I would challenge each and every one of you that, you know, we are all in own shares in the future of the world, and that either you show up and become part of the Underground Railroad, if you will, and become a abolitionist, because poverty is slavery. And so we would invite each of you. Michelle here is part of that. Erica, you know, there's a number of us, Elizabeth, who are working on personhood of the river, working on putting together a alternate plan around this 48 acres and a school, and looking at the educational opportunities that they have. Like I said, they really have treated the river as if it's a backdrop on Hollywood set, as an accessory, and they have had showed little regard or interest in the kind of intellectual capital. They've done their best to kind of box us all out of the conversation, because the city folks have already, they've got it in their head that this is the best project, because they want this to be their legacy. And we know that given all of the universities here in this community, that we can build a better mousetrap. So I would invite any of you here to talk to Michelle, to Erica, to Elizabeth, and we need all the help that we can if we're going to turn back the oppressors.
We have a meeting on Sunday.
Sunday we have a meeting, where? At McAllister? At 2 to 4.
Terminal is right next to the shingle factory, right?
Bing, 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 bing.
And then Northern Metals is right there, or is about to go away. The Condorator is still going. There's so much pollution up there, so much pollution. And what, if anything, has been talked about those spaces and the pollution and just building this sort of amphitheater? It's crazy.
One of the big questions has been over, of that 48 acres, how much is dedicated to parkland? So I think there's about 19 plus acres that are right now Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board would take, and then they're doing planning right now for what kind of park they could create along the river here. So I think the issue is, should that be more than 19 acres, which is what some people are raising. So I'll let Michael address it.
Well, you know, one of the things, the kind of bait and switch, is they came in, they said, well, you know, poor North Minneapolis youth have not been afforded the same benefits that all the kids up and down the river in South Minneapolis and the Grand Round, and so we want to do better. We should be doing better. Well, that was, again, part of the bait and switch, because when they actually designed their plan and we started looking at it, they did not, their design actually had the pathway for the park actually to the rear of the development. And so that was the first signal that they really, it really wasn't about wealth creation, it was really about wealth extraction. And so, and that the fact that there was no environmental, no mention of the river, you know, really was kind of the red flag and the flare that we can't tolerate this, and anybody of any good conscience would not accept this. It goes back to the Boston Tea Party. No, we're paying for this, folks. Wake up. Do we want to continue to invest in the rich and the powerful, or are we going to start realizing that we are the citizens of this country and we have the powers in our hands and we must assume the position? And if we sit back quietly, if we sit on our hands and allow other people to design these holocausts, then we will continue to go to not move forward into a harmonious nation or even a harmonious river. And so that's what it's talking about. It's really about values, it's about virtues, and it's about vision. And each and every one of you have an investment in this, and you can either step up and be part of the solution, or you are indeed part of the problem.
Impassioned remark. I'm going to close this session so we can make time for some of the other events happening. I want to remind you that we have mud stenciling, we have a sound installation just behind you, and then soon we'll be starting a film series across the coffin over there. It's going to be hard to get that metaphor out of my mind. So can you join me in thanking our panelists?